When you have insurance, it's easy to forget about your out-of-pocket costs. That can be a lot of money. How do you know you're not overpaying? HealthLock can help. HealthLock is a technology company that securely connects with your insurance and reviews your claims for overbilling, wrong codes, and even fraud. To date, HealthLock has saved its members over $130 million. To save, visit healthlock.com. Do it today before you see another healthcare provider.
You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or artificial nonsense. It's just pure goodness in every pouch. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. That's Symbiotica.
Hi, I'm Molly Jongfast, and this is Fast Politics, where we discuss the top political headlines with some of today's best minds. And Peter Navarro has become the first Trump White House official to report to prison over January 6th. We have such a great show for you today. Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester talks to us about her Senate run, as well as being a co-chair of the Biden campaign. Then we'll talk to former political reporter Amy Chozick about her new Max show, The Girls on the Bus, which is inspired by her time on the 2016 campaign trail. But first, we have the host of the Bulwark's daily podcast, The Bulwark's Tim Miller. Welcome back to Fast Politics, Tim Miller.
Boom. Ready to be here. Let's do this.
You know, it's funny because it's like I was thinking, we were just chatting before. I was like, I really do like you so much. When I ever end up on a panel with you, I'm always just delighted to talk to you. But I also like, I think that watching the RNC be destroyed with a sledgehammer must be a little bit uncomfortable for you.
No, it's a little satisfying, actually. So thank you for asking. And I love being on with you always, too. You know, it's been nice to be doing the Bulwark podcast where I'm asking people questions. And it's, as you know, it's like a new skill. You're trying to draw people out and all that. But, you know, sometimes I just like to let it rip. And, you know, we can come over here and you can just put it on a tee for me and let me let it rip. And like in this situation, which is, yeah, these fuckers are getting exactly what they've deserved for a long time now. And it's been a long time coming. And what they have done to the RNC during the Ron Romney years was absolutely shameful. They should all feel ashamed. And I'm glad that they're running out of money. And I'm glad that they are now officially a cult to like the daughter-in-law of the president, which is a former president, excuse me, which is very bizarre and very freakish. And it's everything they deserve.
It is interesting to me. And I'm curious what you think about this. Like, so Ronna gets in trouble because she can't raise money. Yep. So they decide to put someone in there who absolutely doesn't know any of the donors. I mean, maybe she knows a few of them, but who does not have nearly the same kind of experience raising money.
Yeah, I mean, Ronna was just a classic fall girl in this thing. The question is why it took so long. long, really, you know, because she had just had loss after loss after loss. You know how I monitor my MAGA Twitter feeds and all these guys, and I saw a funny quote from somebody where I guess my old boss, Reince, was on Sean Hannity saying, okay, this is what Lara needs to do. It's easy. Like, you just got to raise $40 million in the first month, and then you do this, and then you do that, and then you do the other thing. And one of the MAGA guys I followed was like, wait, maybe this guy should have been in charge. And I was like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Okay, good luck, Lara. It's just going to be so easy, girl. You're just going to have to raise $40 million. No big deal. You've never done anything. You've never really had a job in your life. Here you go. Good luck.
You think about Mike Johnson, it's a similar situation. You know, Democrats are always like, we didn't put our fifth or sixth guy in there.
Yeah, it is a similar situation. You know, it was funny. I saw, so they had this little confab out at the Greenbrier in West Virginia.
Yes.
Weekend. A lot of weird stuff was leaking out of that. Like, Tom Emmer was like, Joe Biden was too mean to us at the State of the Union. We shouldn't invite him back next year if he wins. I was like, what? What is wrong with you guys? Okay, so that was one. Then Patrick McHenry, you know, the little guy with the bow tie who was the heir apparent to McCarthy that they passed over for being too establishment or whatever. He's been ripping Johnson ever since Johnson took over. And you know, he was saying to reporters, like, well, he's doing a little bit better. You know, it's kind of like how you're talking about your kid as they're learning how to read or learning how to ride a bike or something.
Right.
You're like, well, we're taking the training wheels off now. And, you know, he can go a full block by himself without any help. And so, you know, I guess I haven't seen a lot of evidence that he's doing better. You know, he hasn't had to actually make any of the hard decisions. Like, he keeps kicking the can with these little mini extensions CRs. For a few weeks. Yeah. And it's like, eventually, you know, the rubber's going to meet the road. And they're either going to have to vote to fund Ukraine and need Democrats to get it passed, or they're not. And they're going to either have to vote to keep the government open and need Democrats to get it passed, or they're not going to keep the government open. And at those moments, we'll see how little Mike Johnson is doing, how much he's improved.
Yeah. It doesn't seem like he is still able to, like, he really is one of those people sort of thinking that he can pull the rabbit out of the hat. The good news is that they somehow managed not to shut down the government. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it's good news. So I just want to be abundantly clear about this so nobody misunderstands. In the crazy Nazi right, there's this thing sense called accelerationism. They're accelerationists. They like want the race war. They're rooting for it. I am not rooting for the race war. I am kind of an accelerationist when it comes to the Republicans' demise. So, you know, this whole let's let them, give them a little more leash, give them a little more leash, give them a little time, let's work with them. I interviewed a couple weeks ago Jake Auchincloss from Massachusetts, who I really like. And that guy is just a Democrat. And he's basically just like, I'm not voting for these little extensions, you know, like put up or shut up, like either let's either fund the government and fund Ukraine or not. And I kind of side with him on that. And so I guess it's good that the government hasn't been shut down, but I think it's time to put the screws to this guy and say, okay, look, you're either going to be with the crazies in your caucus and you're going to cut off your nose to spite your face by shutting down the government, or you're going to be an adult and a grown-up, and you're going to work with Democrats to fund our obligations and to support our friends in Ukraine and deal with the consequences.
Yeah, I mean, those are the choices, right? I mean, ultimately, Republicans are sort of hoping that there's some third choice. At the end of the day, the Republican Party is still very much run by Trump.
Oh my God. Yeah, and obviously the party's still controlled by Trump. You can see it with Johnson. I mean, you can see it in all these primaries. I mean, maybe not every single one. There could be some weird exceptions. But look, I mean, Johnson can't do anything. None of these guys can do anything without knowing that Trump will have their back. And the TikTok thing will be an interesting another example of this, right? Like, it passes 50-0 initially in committee. And then Trump comes out and is like, no, I'm not for it anymore because some billionaire that wants to give me money and I'm desperate for money says I shouldn't be for it anymore. And so now, like, the rubber is going to meet the road on that, right? It's going to be like, are these Republicans going to back down again, just like they did on immigration, just like they did on all these other things, but to appease Mr. Trump? Or are there any areas where he doesn't control them?
Trump is having kind of an incredible cash crunch. I mean, it's one thing not to be liquid. It's another thing. Like, so he owes $500 million. Again, my favorite tweet of the week was that Republican from Fox, the guy, Mark Levin?
Mark Levin, yeah. They call him the Great One.
Do they really? And why?
Yeah, they call him the Great One. I don't know. The bar is so low over there that if, you know, somebody can do four-syllable words, they think they're a genius. I don't know.
I'm going to read you this quote. I know you've seen it because I feel that you will have hilarious things to say about it. Why are there no Republican multi-billionaires offering to lend President Trump the funds to file his appeal in the outrageous case in New York State? And none of them liquid enough to help or join with others to help? This is an outrage.
You first, Mark. Let's see how much you got in your savings account. Let's put it up. You know? I don't know. Why not? Mark Levin. Yeah, I mean, I think that the obvious answer for that listeners of this podcast know is that generally rich people do not like to loan money to like one of the greatest welchers in the history of the world. It's another example of the fuck around and find out principle of Trump, right? Which is like, eventually these bills come due, in this case, literally. And a lot of these guys don't want to give money. And it's astonishing, frankly, like how much money he has got from Rubes to fund his various legal defenses, given his track record of scams and bankruptcies and screwing over people that loaned him money or did work for him. So no, I don't think that a couple of billionaires would come to his defense. But here's the thing I'm worried about, and I think everybody should be worried about, is who might come to his defense? Who might come to his aid here and give him some loans? Foreign interests?
Right. You know? The Saudis.
Yeah, Saudis, people with big deals before the government, you know, people that are going to want bailouts from the government on the back end. I don't know. Like, I think that it's a big, big question and a big, big vulnerability to have a presidential candidate that is like desperate for bond cash. You know, I think that there is just some potential leverages, you know, and this is why, like, we have, if you want to go work in the White House, you have to have a background check. And let me tell you, if you want to go work in the National Security Agency, one of the NSSEC agencies, and you had hundreds of billions of dollars in liens, you know, out against you, you're not going to get the job. All right. There's going to be concerns that you could be a ripe target for foreign influence operations. And so that should be concerning about a presidential candidate. But, you know, the types of Republicans that pretend to care about this stuff, your Marco Rubio's, your Tom Cottons, they've just been completely castrated and are just unwilling to say anything if it involves Trump.
Right. Again, I'm going to ask you an impossible question, but I'm just curious what you if you'll answer it and what you think about it. Do you think that in their heart of hearts, these people think this is going to work? Or do you think they know that they just have to go along with Trump?
Yeah, I have to tell you, I mean, obviously it's different for different people, but just as a broad brush, something that's been pretty alarming to me is I think that a lot of them have now gotten very deep into a bubble and a kind of resentment fueled bubble where they look out and they say, oh man, you know, these media people are so unfair to us. The Never Trumpers are so unfair to us. And we survived the first Trump administration. Well, there was the one that one day with the Capitol storming. But if you just fast forward past that, like most of it was pretty good, right? Most of it was fine. We got our tax cuts and, you know, they've all just kind of rationalized this. I guess one of the most revealing, I think, insights into the mind of this crowd that I've listened to recently, which I'd recommend, is Jamie Weinstein over at The Dispatch interviewed Dan Crenshaw. And I would love to interview Dan Crenshaw, but he's too scared to call on the Bulwark podcast. But yeah, he was willing to do The Dispatch podcast. And it was like, you could just hear him kind of convincing himself in real time that the Never Trumpers were overstating what happened on January 6th, and it wasn't really that bad. And Trump's foreign policy was pretty good. It was just his words that were bad, and the words don't matter, and the actions matter, right? And it's like, oh, everybody's so mean to me for trying to apologize to him, and I did my best, right? Like, it's just, you can just hear this real-time rationalization happening. And I kind of think that is pretty representative of where most of these guys are. And I think they all have legitimate fears and concerns at some level, but they're more intense feeling is of resentment towards, you know, Dems, libs, the elite, the media, however you want to put it.
Yeah. And maybe that's why they want to stick it to Dems and they feel that nominating Trump will do that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Some of these people probably wouldn't have wanted to nominate Trump if they could wave a wand. but they just couldn't, didn't have any power to, and didn't want to waste any more political capital. And they're cowards. I think maybe the last time I was on this podcast, I was talking about how few of them had endorsed Nikki Haley, you know, and they had all convinced themselves. It was like, there's no point in trying to campaign. Why should I even do it? And so, you know, I think if you gave any of them, you know, three magic beans, they would use the first one to get rid of Donald Trump, right? But they don't have magic yes. beans. And so instead they cower. Right. And I think that's basically their mindset these days.
One of the problems that Trump has that I have noticed is that he's really having trouble raising money. Right. He's got his donor numbers. He hemorrhaged.
Small dollar donors are even bad.
Yeah. Small dollar donors, big dollar. Nobody's willing to write him a $500 million check. I mean, I'm curious, like I've argued, I have a friend who's a straight journalist who I like to argue with. And he said, well, Trump doesn't need as much money as Biden does, as a normal political candidate does. But don't you think this is a sign that MAGA, they might be all tapped out?
Yeah. You know, I've been spending a lot of time thinking about this. And I don't know that we're going to really know the answer for a few months. And at the one level, I just want to say this. I am not of the view that whoever raises the more money in presidential races like really matters. I think that there's a law of diminishing returns on presidential money, right? That TV ads, there's a certain group of people can be reached with TV ads. Yeah, these guys have only been presidents. A lot of this stuff is kind of baked in with people. And so I think money matters, but I don't think it matters as much as some commentators do. Now, having this big of a gap, though, is pretty noteworthy. And like, it's one thing if it's like, oh, well, whatever, Biden raised 50 million more. And if you divide that between the five states, it's not really that much on balance. But if it's like, he's already raised 50 million more, and that, you know, the gap is going to expand, and Trump doesn't have enough money to run his operations. And, you know, he's also stressed about the money in his personal life because he can't pay these bonds, and he's redirecting money from the RNC that should be going to grassroots. And instead it's going to, you know, pay his lawyers. At some point that has to matter. And at some point only raising 3 million online in the month of January, whatever it was, has to show that, yeah, some of these small dollar donors are like, they don't have any more to give. Eventually, you do run into a limit on this. So I'm not ready to kind of dance on his grave over it yet, but I do think it's a really concerning sign.
Maybe this is just blue and on, but don't you think that, and again, like poor Jesse has heard me bring this up a number of times, and probably the most embarrassing time was when I brought it up to Paul Krugman, but I do bring this up a lot. So you have 1 million people who died of COVID, right? 200,000 before the vaccine, approximately. These are approximate numbers because I don't have them in front of me. Then significantly more after, many of whom had been encouraged by, right, wing media to take horse dewormer, to not take the vaccine, you know, many of which were like really preventable deaths. I had a theory that I could never prove that there was some economic fallout from that, just having less people. And I do wonder, I mean, even though those people maybe didn't turn on Trump, there has to be some voter or the possibility of some voter fallout from that, don't you think?
Yeah, it's a complicated ecosystem, right? Like our politics, it's always evolving and changing a little bit. It's not as static as people want to think it is. It was funny, for the focus group podcast, so long ago, we were listening to like the 2020 focus groups with swing voters, and COVID and just how terrible Trump was at handling that was so front of their mind that, and that's obvious now in retrospect, but like listening to it, it was pretty jarring to hear them talk about him then versus kind of how much you hear about it now with swing voters. So I do think that there was some impact there that it really hurt him in 2020, his mishandling. Then I think that pressing forward, you had the vaccine deaths and how they were over-indexed in red areas. That's been well documented. They're over-indexed among older voters who Trump does better with. And so, you know, I do think that there is potentially some impact about that. I know I was just, you know, thinking about Georgia, for example. You know, you've had still 4 more years of like people from blue states moving into Atlanta. You know, you had an over-indexing of, I think, death rate. That's just something that we know happened in the more conservative parts of Georgia. Now, how does all of that kind of demographic change, which like marginally accrues to Biden's benefit, is that offset by if there's some bleed among black voters, right? If he goes from 92 to 8 to 87-13, right? Is that more people than the demographic change, right? It's kind of tough to do the ledger on all that, but I do think that it made a marginal difference for sure.
Yeah. And again, like enthusiasm with these elections we have are such small margins. The enthusiasm is such an important element. Thank you, Tim Miller.
Molly Jong Fast, thank you. I'm sure I'll be back soon. I'm waiting for that chart on who's been guest the most times. I just want to kind of see where I am on the power rankings. That's some homework for guests.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
Had enough of those supplements that leave you feeling nothing? Symbiotica is your solution to great-tasting, all-natural supplements that actually work. Crafted with premium plant-based ingredients, their products have no seed oils, fillers, or toxins. Try them out and actually feel the difference today. Visit Symbiotica.com and use code IHEART for 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Again, that's 15% off plus free shipping on your subscription order. Go to Symbiotica.com. C-Y-M-B-I-O. T-I-K-A.com.
AI might be the most important new computer technology ever. It's storming every industry, and literally billions of dollars are being invested. So buckle up. The problem is that AI needs a lot of speed and processing power. So how do you compete without costs spiraling out of control? It's time to upgrade to the next generation of the cloud. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, or OCI. OCI is a single platform for your infrastructure, database, application development, and AI needs. OCI has 4 to 8 times the bandwidth of other clouds, offers one consistent price instead of variable regional pricing, and of course, nobody does data better than Oracle. So now you can train your AI models at twice the speed and less than half the cost of other clouds. If you want to do more and spend less like Uber, 8x8, and Databricks Mosaic, take a free test drive of OCI at oracle.com/strategic. That's oracle.com/strategic. Oracle.com/strategic.
At JCPenney, fashion counts for everybody and every body. The weather is getting warmer and it's time to swap my winter layers for fun, vibrant, and cool clothing. With so many fun things happening this spring, like Mother's Day and the Wind Down Tour, it's hard to find great looking clothes that fit you just right. That's why I love JCPenney. JCPenney has so many stylish and comfortable options for so many different body types. I've been blown away by their selection and everything hugs my body in all the right spots. Refresh your wardrobe this spring with style that gets you. Something to wear that fits your favorite moments of the season at prices that feel just as good. Discover brands that get you and put style and comfort first, like Worthington and Liz Claiborne for her, each in women's petite and plus sizes. Here, spring comes in all shapes, sizes, and colors. JCPenney, make everybody count.
Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester represents Delaware's 1st District. Welcome to Fast Politics, Congresswoman Lisa. Wait, do you say your whole last name?
So a lot of times we go by LBR. Sometimes it's the whole Lisa Blunt Rochester.
I feel like LBR is good because like when you're going by initials, you know, you've hit the big time.
Well, I definitely feel like an LBR. I love it.
So I want to talk to you. You are the congresswoman from Delaware and you're running for the Senate. You will be, this is like an obsession of mine. Will you only be the 4th Black woman senator or the 3rd?
The 4th in the history of the country. And
insane.
Yeah. Like think about it. And only 2 of them have been elected. And that would be Carol Moseley Braun, who was the 1st. And then you've got the vice president, Kamala Harris, as the 2nd. And then the 3rd is appointed and currently serving. That's LaFonza Butler, who was appointed after the passing of Dianne Feinstein by Governor Newsom. So there's only been 3 in the history of the country. And, you know, hopefully I will be number 4.
It's what my people call a Shonda. It's just so blatantly incredibly infuriating to me that you will be the 4th Black woman ever to be in the Senate. It's crazy.
It truly is mind-blowing. I mean, even in 2016, when I won my seat in Congress, I was the 1st woman and 1st person of color elected to Congress from Delaware. And so, you know, you would think in this day and age, we wouldn't still be hearing about firsts, but it's all the more reason why we got to keep going. It's all the more reason why you got to break those ceilings, bust down those doors. And as the late, great Shirley Chisholm, the first Black woman in the House, said, if they don't give you a seat at the table, you can bring a folding chair.
Yeah. Can we talk for 2 seconds about how inherently racist and sexist America is and how much harder Black women have to work? You know, it's true for white women, but not the way it's true for Black women. Like, I just see KJP is judged just at a totally, at a much harsher level than someone like Kirby. And I know that you have prevailed and you're, you know, now running for the Senate. But it just is so shocking to me how much it's so baked into everything.
You know, it's interesting, Molly. Years ago, I went to this Black women's conference and I heard this term that like stuck with me. It's be conscious, but not consumed. And what that meant, especially to me, because even in Delaware, I was the first Black woman Secretary of Labor. I've had these positions where you sometimes walk into a room and you are the only one. And in that conference, what they talked about is that you got to be conscious of it. Yeah, isms exist. Racism, classism, sexism, these isms exist. But to the extent that I get consumed by that, I'm ineffective. I'm not breaking that door open. And so part of it is, you got to be conscious of it, because when it's time to do things, we do feel the difference. You know, whether it's walking into a room and feeling I better be 10 times better or smarter or whatever. But at the same time, knowing that I've got to be effective. And in order for me to be effective, I've got to be conscious, but not consumed. And so for me, that's sort of how I operate. And I think it gives me a different lens for other folks that walk in the room and maybe they're the only ones. I worked for a think tank that focused on the inclusion of people with disabilities. And you think about how, you know, we do things with bias that we don't even know sometimes that we have. Or, you know, I've lived in over 30, you know, and traveled and worked and played in over 30 countries in the world. My son was born in France. I lived in Shanghai. How it feels to be the other coming into a place. And so I think I try to bring those lived experiences with me to the work, you know, and that's what's so valuable about having representation in the Senate, is that we have different lived experiences. I know what it's like to have a son who stopped by the police at night as a Black mom, but at the same time, as a congresswoman, I helped to bring together community activists and law enforcement and get body-worn cameras in my state. It's because I had those lived experiences and those relationships. So I always say conscious, but not consumed.
Really important point. And I think that's so interesting. So now you are the national co-chair of the Biden re-election campaign. What does that mean? Are you a surrogate and are you out there? And what does that look like?
Yeah, well, this is actually my second time being a co-chair of the Biden-Harris campaign. It was so nice. They asked me twice. And so I am very excited about being on the campaign trail as a co-chair. I do a little bit of everything, you know, from providing advice. We have co-chair meetings to actually being in different parts of the country, whether it's being on radio or TV or opening up a grand opening for one of our offices, you know, and kind of motivating those folks and also helping with fundraising. And then just, again, giving advice on things that we see. And, you know, I will tell you, when I first was asked by President Biden in the first term to come on board and be a, you know, endorse him right out the gate, it was really after having a one-on-one conversation with him and, you know, seeing and feeling and hearing what his motivation was. And that motivation of, you know, restoring the soul of this country, making sure that everybody gets a fair chance and gets opportunity, those things are still relevant today. And as somebody who has lived through one term of Donald Trump and one term of Joe Biden, I can tell you there is a serious and real difference between the two of them and who they stand for and how they operate and how effective they've been. And so I am excited again to be a national co-chair. And we're doing everything we can to make sure they are reelected.
Do you think Black voters are still with Biden? Do you think it's a challenge to win them back? What are you seeing in that group? Do you think that he's speaking enough to those voters?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that is important for us as a campaign and is one of the hallmarks of who he is and who they are as a team is that we don't take any vote for granted. And I think that's really important that we want to hear from people. We want them to see, feel and hear the things that we've accomplished, but also know that there is a vision for the future that includes things like voting rights, that includes reproductive freedoms. And, you know, I had heard a recent data point that even for something like reproductive rights and abortion rights, the Ohio election, I had heard that Black men showed up and voted in more in favor than any other group, because I think sometimes people make assumptions about groups based on polls instead of really talking to people and the things that are important to our communities. First of all, we're not monolithic. Different people have, you know, different backgrounds and different motivations. But access to capital and the fact that we now have, you know, the lowest unemployment rate in the Black community, the greatest investment in HBCUs. My two kids and my daughter-in-law, they all graduated from HBCUs. And so to actually like put their money where their mouth is, meaning, you know, the Biden-Harris administration, that's important to people. And then in Delaware, we have a lot of people don't realize we're the lowest mean elevation state in the country. And so climate is important. And, you know, like we got the beaches, but we also have farmers. We also have environmental justice communities. And so this president, again, has put his money where his mouth is and really invested in those communities, clean drinking water, air quality monitors. Those are two of the things that I've worked on personally because I heard it from my constituents. And so I think for us, we take nobody for granted. We're going to work hard for everyone's vote. And we're also going to like meet people where they are. And that's important as well. You know, so I'm excited about being on the road and talking to people and hearing from them. And I'm really excited that President Biden and Vice President Harris have really listened, even on things like the Safer Communities Act. You know, I was able to get a piece of legislation in that's called Break the Cycle of Violence, which because one of the inspirations for me running in the first place was because my city of Wilmington was being called Murder Town because of gun violence. And so they're listening. And, you know, like I said, for me, it was a weird situation that propelled me to run. But the inspiration and the ability to do the work makes me even more want to go to the Senate and do it on a deeper level.
It is so interesting when we talk about climate and we talk about these little states, because Rhode Island, too, Senator Whitehouse is one of the great, I feel like, climate senators. Rhode Island, too, has done a lot of really interesting stuff with climate. Gina Raimondo, now in the admin, but another person who I think of as someone who's very focused on this sort of transition to clean energy and a sort of more sustainable way of living. So I'm curious, in Delaware, what is the sort of, what do you feel like are the priorities when it comes to climate?
One of the great things that I was able to work on with my senior senator, who is actually the chairman of Environment and Public Works, Tom Carper, is a bill called the Shore Act. And it really is about the resiliency and protection of not just our shores, but our riverbanks. I mean, I went to towns in like inland that because of the flooding, they were feeling it not just on the beach, but in off of riverbanks. And so part of what we are working on is legislation that deals with that, you know, making sure that we are looking at the prevention side of it. But then we got to mitigate the risks. And so, you know, we are doing, I also am on the health subcommittee. So we have a health aspect to this as well when it pertains to clean air and clean air monitors to make sure, you know, that our air is okay. And then working with the administration, with the president, one of the bills I had was called the Alert Act, is that if there's an environmental spill, if there's something that happens, communities need to and have a right to be notified of what happened, when it happened, and what the plan is for it. And so doing those kind of things, I think, is really important. But it kind of takes me back, like, Molly, when I first decided to run, is kind of, first of all, the guy that I just mentioned, Tom Carper, I worked for him back in 1988. I went to a town hall meeting with my two-year-old son on my hip. I was a grad student, and I didn't even realize that I was pregnant at the time. And he told me they had internships. And that internship turned into me being a caseworker in a congressional office, to being in his cabinet as Deputy Secretary of Health and Social Services and Secretary of Labor, and then going on to work for our first woman governor and, you know, working for the Urban League. But it was really after, this is a story, but after a 20-year marriage, and I always quote Beyonce because I love Beyonce, but in her song, You Won't Break My Soul, there's a line that says, I just fell in love. I just quit my job. Well, in 2003, I think it was, I fell in love. I quit my job, sold my house and sold my car, and I moved to Shanghai for love and love of my life, a guy named Charles Rochester. And, you know, Charles and I were living. I wrote a book with two other women. We came back to the States, and he went on a business trip before his meetings, ruptured his Achilles tendon, and blood clots went to his heart and lungs. And at 52, the love of my life passed away.
Mm.
I did not know what was next. I knew that I was, you know, sad and mad. And some days I tell people just getting up in the morning was a success. And it was maybe 8-9 months later, I was on autopilot in the supermarket, and I saw a dad in front of me with two or three kids. And he put back grapes because they were $9. And it just snapped me out of my own pain. Like I said, I'm blessed. I'm okay. I got a house. I've got family. I've got mental health care. But a lot of other people were struggling. And it was like, I don't have anything to lose. My city was being called Murder Town. I was like, I'm going to run. And I decided to run for Congress. And I was in a six-way primary debating lawyers. I had never even been in a debate before, let alone run for anything. And we won. And I guess part of my message is, to me, the Senate is an opportunity to do all this work in an even deeper level, to be able to work on the planet, to be able to work on giving people jobs and making sure we have a strong economy and healthcare. It's also the place where I can fight for democracy. And that's, to me, having been trapped in the gallery on January 6th, this moment is real, you know, and I want people to feel that sense of urgency about the choice that we have between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. This moment is real. Who you put in the Senate, who you put in the House, who you put on your school board. This moment is real. And we've got to make sure that we take advantage of it and that we use our power.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point. And also, you know, something that I write a lot about, this idea that it is one of the most important elections of our lifetime. I can't believe we keep having these elections. I just want to have normal elections where we beat Mitt Romney.
You and me both.
Right? Who's a very nice guy, but, you know.
Right.
Talk to us about January 6th for a second, because, I mean, it must be hard to be a member of Congress, to have lived through this, to have seen Republican members run for their lives, and then the cognitive dissidents.
Yeah, it's so strange because that day, you know, I had served as a co-chair of the campaign. So for me, this was the culmination of all that work on the campaign trail with, you know, with Joe Biden and Kamala and being a part of the team. And I was like, okay, I will be there to witness the certification. And Nancy Pelosi said to members, you can volunteer to take shifts up in the gallery, up where, like, the balcony area, to watch what is going to happen. Well, we never got to shift number two, because while we were up there, we could hear the banging. We could see people skirted off of the floor, all of the leadership first, and then all of the members. And then I don't know if people forgot that we were up in that gallery, but we were trapped. We could hear the noises outside of those doors. We were told to put on gas masks, the hoods that were under our chairs that we didn't even know were there or didn't even know how to open them. And we were crawling up and down, just trying to get to some place that we thought was safe. And I will never forget it because I feel it like it was yesterday. I could look down and see guns being pointed at one door, and I could hear the gunshot at the other door. And, you know, in that moment, and I tell people it was almost an out-of-body thing. I could feel history. I could feel our ancestors. I could feel like time going by. And all I could think to do, I was pray. And I prayed for everybody, you know. I didn't just pray for one group of people, you know. And I could feel other members touching my back or touching my arm as I prayed. And then they let us out of that room. And I will tell you, on the anniversary, it was important to me to not forget what happened. So to remember, to reflect on how close we were to losing it, and then to recommit to our democracy. Like, I felt more on fire to do the work than ever before. And I think that this moment, again, it is important for people to know we were close. And when Donald Trump starts talking about words like bloodbath, that ain't about cars, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, he was talking about American carnage in the first one. And there's a great Maya Angelou quote: when somebody shows you who they are, believe them. He's telling us who he is. He's telling us what he will do. We also know that Joe Biden is telling us what he would do in a second term. And so we just need to see what people have done. Think about it. I've been one president who talked about infrastructure. Joe Biden did infrastructure, you know. One president who talked about a fair tax code. Joe Biden really is doing a fair tax code, not just for rich people, but for all of us. Just look at the record, look at who they are, and look at how they even talk. I believe that as this election goes and the more people hear and remember who Donald Trump is, they'll remember why they need to have that sense of urgency, not only for Joe's campaign, but even for people like me, to support people like me. The theme of my campaign is Bright Hope, which was the church my grandmother attended for 70 years. And it is not just a church name. It is a way of being when you feel dark. And in this moment, people feel dark. But I'm like, look, if you just got a match size light, our match lights coming together can create something bright. And that's what I'm trying to bring to the Senate, Bright Hope. And so yeah. And hey, if anybody out there likes what you hear, go to LisaBluntRochester.com. My little shameless plug.
Yes, that's good. That was great. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I hope that you will come back.
I hope you will have me back, Molly. I really enjoyed this.
Amy Chozick is the creator of the new Max series, The Girls on the Bus, and author of the New York Times bestseller, Chasing Hillary. Welcome to Fast Politics, Amy Chozick.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be here.
Delighted to have you. So talk to us about how you got to this book and then to the show, The Girls on the Bus.
Sure. Well, I was a political reporter for many years. I covered Hillary Clinton and Obama in 2008 when I was at the Wall Street Journal. And then when I was at the New York Times for many years, I covered the 2016 campaign, Hillary, Trump, all of that. I wrote a book that came out in 2018, a memoir about covering both of Hillary's campaigns and how that sort of took over my life. That ended up getting optioned by Warner Brothers, landing with the producer, Greg Berlanti. And we got together and started scheming up a fictional backdrop that would be inspired by my book for female journalists covering a fictional Democratic primary. That became The Girls on the Bus, a Max series that came out last week. So that's a short version of how it came about.
That is like the dream, having your memoir made into a television show. So explain to us, you covered the sort of campaign that broke all our brains,
yes.
2016. How have you sort of moved on in your life from that moment? Because, I mean, it's one thing to have watched it from the outside. I can't even imagine the level of feeling you must have had from living it on the inside.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard to move on. And actually, I think one of the beautiful things about the process of turning it into fiction, I know it's a TV show, but I turning it into a form of art, like, is cathartic. You know, it was very cathartic for me. And I think being able to, very initially, for the very first conversation, we said, nobody wants to relive the 2016 campaign. This has to be fiction. But in a way, I was able to kind of explore all of the themes, all of the things still kicking around in my head. Every day I'd come to the writer's room. A lot of people say, like, what were you adamant about keeping in the book? And it was much less like, this thing from the book has to be in the show, and much more my partner asking me, what's a conversation you wish you would have had, or what's the thing you wish you would have done that you didn't? And so being able to play in this fictional world, I got to have all of these. If you get to watch the whole season, in the finale that I wrote in particular, there's a conversation between the journalist and a female candidate. You know, these are conversations you never get to have in real life. So it was actually very cathartic to be able to do that. We created a Democratic National Convention, and I got some of my friends from the real political world, Jen Palmieri and Eric Schultz and some others, to make cameos. It was so fun. But Jen Palmieri was like pretending to check press in at the state. It looked so real. Our production value was amazing. And we looked at each other, and it was just like the weirdest, most meta feeling. Because I'm like, oh, the last time you were doing this, it was at the real one. And it's so strange. And we've like sort of rewritten history here in our fictional world. So it's a great question. It's been a pretty cathartic process.
So one of the things that readers always get upset about, and I say this as someone who's married to a normal, furious Democrat, is that they get mad at conventional political reporting because they feel that it doesn't necessarily meet the moment with journalism. What do you think about that now that you're sort of in a completely different world? You live in LA.
Yeah, that's true. I do live in LA. If you ask me about specifics, I'll be like, I don't know. I was at the farmer's market. Like, you know, right. But that...
I mean, but what do you think about the idea that normal political reporting can't meet the moment?
I mean, that is something that I think so much about. And given we made a light dramedy, but this is sort of the central premise of what we were exploring. If we covered politics differently, would we have different politics? Right.
That's a great line, though. If we covered politics differently, would we have different politics?
Well, what do you think? Would we?
Yeah, well, no, it's a great question.
It's like, I think that genie's out of the bottle. So it's not like I'm here professing to know the answer, but it is something.
No, it's a great question.
It's something I think about, whether it's the fact that, you know, whether it's a false balance. Obama used to always complain about false balance, but I think those complaints have even gotten much more heightened when you're comparing a candidate to Trump or other Republicans. But so I think the false balance debate is, and also I, you know, something that frustrated me, and by the way, I take responsibility for this, but the idea that like no policy, nothing that actually impacts people's lives ever broke through. And I don't, you know, I would like fly to Lansing, Michigan to cover a speech on economics or public private partnership, you know, some kind of interesting wonky thing that Hillary loves to talk about it. And I would write like 2000 words on it. And then people would be like, oh, you write about his emails. And I'm like, I actually write about the other things. They just don't break through. I mean, I think The Daily has done a good job of like biting off a policy thing, going deep in it. So I really think the emphasis is on us. But that was a frustration. Like I did an event here for Franklin Foer. Yeah, like Franklin Foer's book is filled with policies that the Biden administration accomplished that, and this is my own LA ignorance, I guess. I'm like, I had no idea about the chips. So like, how do we do that? How does that break through? I just don't know in this current ecosystem.
That's a really good point about how important policy is and how hard it is to get readers interested in it, but also I would say to cover it in a way that makes it feel germane to their lives, right?
Okay.
I mean, that's the, you know, for example, like people, I mean, I've talked so much about fucking chips, and it's because it's like, it is a paradigm shift, right? The idea to bring, that we're going to bring chip manufacturing back to the United States from Taiwan because of the danger of China. I mean, really, that's what it is. So like, it's two part, right? To bring American manufacturing back, but also because of the enormous threat that China poses and because everything we own has got these chips. So I wonder though a lot about like the larger shift of chips, right, is that it will eventually, if you live in a, you know, a town in Michigan or Wisconsin or wherever it is they're putting the factories, I think some are in Ohio, you know, that you now go work in a chip factory. It also, a lot of this stuff has these very complicated tax incentive structures that are not something readers like can grasp in a few lines, right? I mean, that is a larger question, is it's just hard to convey that. But it is interesting. And I do think, like, how anxious do you feel? And now I feel like you're so, are in a totally different world. So I feel like this is, I think it's like actually quite useful to think of this stuff in hindsight sometimes. How much anxiety did you feel about the worry of seeming partisan?
You know what? The more I think about it, the more I feel like it's How many people really think that the New York Times or CNN reporters are running around and they're actually Republicans? Like, I just don't right. know. I think we really, we you know, it's very important as serious news people to project objectivity. I just think it's a it's sort of a false contradiction. It's a contradiction in terms. I just don't. And you know what? Partly that's because of the way newsrooms have been hiring for the last 20 years. When I started at the Wall Street Journal as a news assistant, some of the best investigative journalists did not have a college, didn't go to college. Like it was still a, it was still sort of a trade,
and
it was
still,
yeah, and it was still like a middle class trade, and it recruited from people from all over the country. I think mostly newsrooms are from elite universities now, and anyway, I think the structure of who populates the media has changed, and I think kind of pretending that you're not biased is actually sort of dishonest in a way. I mean, that's sort of the debate. That's a debate that we get into, this kind of objectivity versus authenticity. But, you know, and when I started at the Times, a lot of the senior political journalists didn't vote in elections they covered because you had to declare your party. And I understand, but I don't know. I just feel like now to pretend that you're going into a Trump rally and you're just as sympathetic to the people you're interviewing as when you're going to, who are we kidding? I don't know the answer, but I feel like there is something about being honest with readers. This is how I feel about women's rights, because I'm a woman. That said, right. I'm still going to be tough on this candidate who screwed up. Like, I think you can be fair and still be honest that, like, you're a human being with opinions. You know?
Yeah, I think that's right. It's really interesting to just sort of talk about this stuff. You know, I wrote a piece about, like, the autocrat stuff yesterday. And, like, my editor, who I love so much, was like, there are many, many questions in this piece. He was like, you know, if you want to just do more opinion and less of it. And it's like, because there are so many questions about, like, modern political reporting, there aren't, like, really clear answers for any of this, right? I mean, the larger question is, how does a free press cover an autocracy and, you know, or a wannabe autocrat? And I don't know the answer to that.
If we're all operating under the guise of objectivity because it makes us more trustworthy, like, guys, it's not working. Like, we've never been trusted last.
It's true. That's a good point.
I mean, I don't want everything to descend. I would hate for everything to descend into like a hot take opinion piece. I firmly believe in journalism and reporting. I just think that this whole idea of, I don't know, like it's at the, right. they trust us less than they ever did.
Yeah. I mean, it's the problem of American institutions, right? Mm-hmm. Like there's always a sense in which we're always having this argument, like, have the guardrails held. And like the reality is, you know, no, you know, right. If you can work four different trials to put them off so you can run for president, then obviously the guardrails haven't held. Right. And the question is, like, you know, are American institutions as safe as we think they are? And obviously they're not. Or they've always been, you know, a kleptocracy, and the affluent white men will always be able to bend them to their will.
Oh, that's dark. That's dark.
Sorry. And it's always been that way. Now we should be talking about your show.
No, it's okay. Because in our show, you know, we wrote it for several years. We went, Julie Fleck and I created it with her. We went to the caucuses in 2020. We were on the Warren bus, bounced around to Bernie, and, you know, we kept rewriting things. You know, it's fiction, but we still wanted to be a little bit, you know, accurate. And we were like, still no woman president. That one we don't have to rewrite. That's fine. That holds. We're like, the only thing that really fucks up our show is if they elect a woman. And then we're like, no, it's fine. It didn't happen.
I shouldn't laugh, but I laugh to keep from crying.
You gotta laugh.
It is so incredibly fucked up how, you know, we've gone through so many machinations. And the one thing that Democrats seem to have agreed on is that it's just completely impossible to elect a woman president. Please, when you listen to this, please don't write me mean emails. I want to have a woman president probably more than anyone in the world. But the anxiety, I think, is such that, it, you know, we're more likely to have a Nikki Haley candidate than a...
I was just about to say that. I've been saying that. Like, if there's a first woman president, she's probably going to be a Republican. I kind of feel that way.
It's so dark. Or it isn't dark. It's subversive in a weird way. After 2016, there was a feeling that nobody ever wanted to relive it. And when you said that, I was thinking about it because, like, I've definitely heard from, like, publishers and this and that. And the reality is, like, yes, and... we are still stuck re-fucking living 2016 right now.
Yeah.
So, like, nobody wants to relive it, and yet we are in a Mobius strip of it. Discuss.
Totally. No, it's fascinating. It's actually, like, I think about that a lot because that was when I got out of political coverage, right? So the bookends of my I was the pool reporter with Obama in 2008. So, like, we watched elections come in. We rode to Grant Park with him in the motorcade. Like, I just happened to be the pool reporter. And then the bookend is the Javits Center, her speech the next day. So I was like, okay, I'm good. Those are the bookends of my political coverage. But no, I think it was such a watershed that it is still reverberating. I think that it's less reverberating like Hillary and Trump, and it's more reverberating of all of the themes that we did. I mean, it was such a wake up moment. I mean, nobody thought that was going to happen, right? And then it happened, right. And it feels like it's still happening. And there's still like a trauma associated with it, I think, for a lot of people who didn't think this could possibly happen. And now it's happening and it's going to happen again. I mean, so I think that it was such a watershed moment that you're right. I didn't want to do like game change the 2016 version. I didn't want to like cast.
Because that makes me want to die.
Yeah. I think Primary Colors and Emma Thompson like killed it as Hillary in that movie. And like, I didn't want to cast Trump. Like, I didn't want to do that. But I think you're absolutely right that like all of the themes that were exposed in 2016 are absolutely things that we're still thinking about. And you can't make a show about politics without weaving those in. And that's certainly kind of the underpinnings of our dramedy are the themes.
Right. I had somebody on this podcast who wrote a book about the election that ruined all our lives. And the hot take was it was 2000.
Oh,
that was the election that ruined all our lives. I was like, wait,
interesting.
What? But it did. It ruined a different generation of lives.
No, and certainly when people, and I don't have a fast answer, like some people, like I've been asked, like, well, why do you think people don't trust the media? I'm like, oh God, where do I start? But I do think certainly the Bush years and the lead up to Iraq, like I think all these, I don't think 2016 happened and distrust in the media happened just because of Trump and a vacuum, right?
I agree. I also think, though, that it's been covered. I don't think it's covered as causality as much as it should, is that some of what happened to the mainstream media is that tech used us for free content and then got mad at us when they got so rich. You know, like Elon is a great example. Like Twitter grows on free content. And then all of a sudden, Elon's like, I don't like any of this. And just because I take a little ketamine, that's not a big story. And fuck the Wall Street Journal. And then, you know, he's like, we don't need journalists. We need random anonymous accounts on X that post videos from 2008. You know, I mean, that's some of it, right?
No, I 1,000%. And that's what's kind of fascinating and terrifying, right? Because the changing economics of the news business, I don't think it's a coincidence that the kind of different economic incentives that have really gutted newsrooms are coinciding with a feeling that media can't be trusted and all of these things and allowing for, as you said, these right-wing forces to take hold. It actually gets back to our policy conversation. You're not going to write a story about the CHIPS plan if you're chasing clicks. And I don't think we're chasing clicks anymore. I think we've kind of moved past that because that doesn't even work.
That's right. Clicks have died. That's right. We are pivoting. We're pivoting to video again.
We're pivoting. Oh, now I heard podcasts with video is the thing.
Yeah, except you say this on a podcast without video.
Thank God. Face for print. No, I also feel for newsrooms that are incredibly understaffed. Like, I think that's, you know, it's like it's all feeding into this. I mean, I think about that sometimes because I do think there's like a nostalgia to the show in that it's like a robust press corps following a, you know, a crowded Democratic primary. Like, oh, what's that like? You know, I think post COVID and now you have basically two incumbents running and it's so expensive to send reporters out in the road that some of that traditional way of covering, good or bad, traditional way of covering campaigns has changed too.
Yeah. Amy Chozick, the show is on Max. You can stream it right now. How many episodes?
There's two episodes out now and another one drops on Thursday.
Yes. All right.
Doing weekly.
Weekly. How many episodes altogether?
There's 10 episodes.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks. Great talking to you.
And now your moment of fuckery.
Jesse Cannon.
Molly Jung-Fast, I hear there's a whole lot of fuckery going on down in Louisiana. What are you seeing here?
So I want to talk about this RH impact report that has been released. It's been released by a think tank. It's from RH Impact, and it is a report. It's called Criminalizing Care, How Louisiana's Abortion Bans Endanger Patients and Clinics. And it's really important statistics about how the state of Louisiana has criminalized women's health care. They have made it more likely there are less hospitals, less doctors, less options for treatment. And one of the many findings they have found is that women are less likely to get treated, more likely to die, more likely to die in childbirth. There's basically existing federal statutes put in place to protect patient access to emergency care, including the federal law called EMTALA, are being nullified by Louisiana's abortion bans, which means if you are dying, you can die in a Louisiana hospital because they don't care. That is our moment of fuckery.
That's it for this episode of Fast Politics. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday to hear the best minds in politics make sense of all this chaos. If you enjoyed what you've heard, please send it to a friend and keep the conversation going. And again, thanks for listening.
I'm late for a very important date.
Time is running out to score adult theme park tickets at child prices from Undercover Tourist. This summer, make your Walt Disney World vacation more affordable than ever. Escape into a place where magic has the power to transport you into stunning worlds and your favorite stories for less. Buy from Undercover Tourist, an authorized seller, and link to official Walt Disney World apps so you can add on Genie Plus and Lightning Lane upgrades easy. Book your adult theme park tickets at child prices with Undercover Tourist now and save. UndercoverTourist.com.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear. This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Are you on the hunt for a new home this spring, but don't know where to start? Fisher Homes is your solution. Your new home should reflect you from the front door to the kitchen and even your outdoor space. Start your journey by selecting your ideal home site, like in a cul-de-sac or that's tree-lined, and then choose from a variety of expertly designed floor plans. Bring it all together at our Lifestyle Design Center. Let Fisher Homes be your new home solution this spring and start making memories at fisherhomes.com.